Hello and welcome once again to Crazy Comics and Stories. It's me, your charming and delightful old Uncle Rat Bastard. And at the other end of the series of tubes and wires that we call the internets is Joe Crazy Writer. How you doing today, Joe?
Shh, keep it quiet. You don't. What you people don't realize is Corey and I are recording on a rare Saturday. But the problem is on Saturday, I usually work. And if you remember from last week, I'm off for, well, we'll talk more about it when we get to freaking and geeking. But what happens is no matter what, I cannot help Chris clean because I just do it all wrong. And so what I did is I snuck down into the basement and I texted Corey and I said, hey, if you're free, let's pod now. So while Chris is busy cleaning, and again, you know, she's pre-coffee. You know, you don't want to talk to my wife if before she's had her coffee or after work, before she's had her wine. And so I'm like, shh, be very, very quiet. I'm hiding from my wife. So what? Shh, I gotta say.
Sorry, dear. Yep, I'll be quiet. I'll be good. Shutting up.
Thanks, Corey. Well, you blew my day. Well, anyway, how are you doing?
I'm awake because I worked last night, so I have to get up at like 5 in the morning to get all the clients up and, you know, get them their breakfast and everything, and then I come home at 8, and I was all set to, you know, take a, you know, just sit and watch some TV. Nope, I get a text from Joe. Hey, want to record? Sure, I'm always ready to record.
Yeah, because here's what I'm thinking. I'm thinking for Corey, like, oh, well, let's get a recording done early. That way he can enjoy the rest of the day. Or like tomorrow, if I'm free, I might call Corey up and you know, maybe we'll get a chance to record a rare fill-in that we have to drop in every so often. And believe me, I regret the error. But I also know Corey
likes
football.
Save that for when we do the fill-in.
Oh, okay. Yeah, but
unless,
I mean, you know,
unless we've made another error.
The thing is we're trying to be proactive about the errors. Because, I mean, how many times have we actually missed dropping a podcast weekly once we actually got our weekly podcast going?
Twice. We have missed it twice, both the week after Christmas.
Yeah. So we always got to remember pre-Christmas to load one up. You know, and that doesn't count the beginning ones where we were just kind of, yeah, we'll put them out, see what happens. Do you recall how that first one, you know, because I talk to you every so often, like how many people are downloading, how many people are listening, blah, blah, blah. Do you recall how that first one was? I mean, were you watching anybody downloading it, or were you just like?
I didn't watch the numbers for, you know, a few months.
Okay.
And then by the time we'd done it for a year, we were getting about 200 to 300. And boy, we were happy.
Oh, yeah. Because we weren't really pushing it on anything. We, other than, you know, we did a Facebook page. We'd mention it. I don't know if you were on the fire-breathing Twitter machine. I've never figured Twitter out.
And we told everybody we knew, which was, you know, all of, you know, 10 people.
Yeah. And I know later on there were flyers and we'd mention it to cons, and I invited comic book people from the Facebook page that I knew. And where are we now, Mr. Strode?
We get between 2,500 and 3,000 downloads in our first month of a new episode. So, hi, everybody.
Hi. Thanks for downloading. And I ask this because,
by the way,
you know,
I do want to point out that the first mass group of downloads that where I kind of went, what the what? Was around episode 60 to 100, there was this podcast aggregator in Germany that picked us up. And we would get 50 to 100 downloads from it every week. And I'm like, who in Germany is listening to us talk about comic books? And I see that, you know, we're still on there. People are still listening. So, hi, Germany.
Hello. Thank you. Danke. Hey, and if you guys want to, like, exchange
comic
books
with
us.
The last 4 years.
Yes.
Sorry for the last 4 years.
I don't regret the error because, to quote Han Solo, it's not my fault, but we regret the error. By the way, if anybody in Germany wants to trade comics, give me a yell. I love foreign comics. One of these days, that may be something. I don't know, Corey, have you collected any foreign comics?
I've got a few here and there, but it's not a big passion of mine. I do not like in British comics.
It's not a big one for me, but if I know you're going to a foreign country, I always ask, if you find a comic book, bring it back. So it's not that it's, you know, oh, I got a comic book from this country. It's actually from someone who bought it at that country. And I've got some real interesting ones, and maybe I'll resurrect the long dormant Solo Joe, and it'll be much like we did with the my sketchbook. I'll have it on my Facebook page so you can go along with me and see what they are. Because the ones that I have actually have stories with them. Like my grandma brought me home a hardcover book that had Fantastic Four and Spider-Man in it. Not really a comic book, more like a kid's storybook. Of course, I don't read a lick of Italian anymore. And then, of course, I have one from Israel, a Popeye one that I, while I was in Boy Scouts, I actually met a Israeli scout. And we exchanged, not so much exchange, but he said, hey, if you're interested in anything, and he sent me things like a Coca-Cola bottle cap in Hebrew, some badges, and he sent me a comic book. And what I thought was interesting, and again, this was back in the 80s, is, you know, he put it all in a package, mailed it to me. And of course, when it hit customs, he ripped that sucker open and checked it out. And I can't help but wonder. I wasn't stupid. I knew they were probably thinking, oh, they're probably worried, like something nefarious. And I'm sure they're wondering, like, huh, a bunch of badges and Coca-Cola bottle caps and a comic book. What the? Put this guy in a file. We're going to have to keep an eye on him.
Badges.
Lately, it's been some of my friends that I met on the road from when I was traveling, and I'd hear they go to Spain. I always send them a quick note saying, hey, would you do this? So that's kind of fun. So, again, you know, maybe I'll have some fun. That's half the fun of having a collection, you know, is being able to show it off, and especially if it's something you can't read.
I have a couple of pieces of news for us to discuss, by the way.
Cool. And we have an anniversary to talk about, too. But let's get the news out of the way.
All right. Marvel announced yesterday the Mighty Marvel Masterworks reprint program. What it is, they will be, it's a new line of books. They are small. They are 6x9, so regular paperback book size. Amazing Spider-Man with Great Power, which is first 10 issues of Spider-Man with Amazing Fantasy number 15. Fantastic Four Volume 1, first 10 issues of that. And the X-Men, first 10 issues of the original 1963 X-Men title. They're going to be smaller size, aimed at the youth market. They didn't say so in the press release, but I would imagine that they're going to be in those Scholastic book fairs. And my first thought on this is, you know, they're wanting to position these books to aim at younger readers. These stories are 55 to 60 years old. While there's a cool factor and all, I think most kids are going to pick them up and go, this is old.
Yeah. I mean, I got my kids interested in my essentials only because they were interested in comics. And they knew Peter Parker started as a high school kid. And I said, well, here's some of the original classic ones, you know. And I basically built up Steve Ditko and Stan Lee and, you know, kind of said, this is how it started. And I think they read maybe half of it, and then they just kind of tapped out because I had to, you know, make sure I get that back to me. I guess I question why Masterworks, because you already have the Epic line. Can't you make it like a mini Epic instead of calling Masterworks? Or maybe you're just trying to keep the, I don't know, maybe it'll sell. I'm dubious.
I don't think you'd want to call it the Epic line because the Epic line are the big, thick books.
Well, that's what I mean. You have an Epic line already.
Yeah. But these are like the little pocketbooks.
Depends on how much it costs. You know, if you're going to charge them $40, again, and that might not be nothing for a kid.
No, it's not. They're going to be cheap. They're going to be, you know, they're going to be cheap. First off, the art's going to be reduced. And I remember reading those pocketbooks when I was a kid. You know, we loved them. But, man, that art was just tiny.
And the with my eyes. I mean, I had to I have to admit I'm getting old. I actually bought myself some reader glasses.
Oh, you got some cheaters.
Yeah, yeah. And I got to admit, when I put them on, I'm like, holy cow, this is nice.
But I still think back, you know, when I was a kid, and they would put Golden Age reprints and stuff. You know, I was interested in the history, and I'd go, oh, cool. But, man, those look weird. And, you know, they were. And those were stories that were only 30 years old. These are 60 years old. I imagine a lot of kids are would, if you got like more current stuff, I would go for Spider-Man. I'd go with Ultimate Spider-Man. X-Men, I don't know, maybe start with the new X-Men because they're going to read the old X-Men and go, this is, where's Wolverine? And the Fantastic Four, I don't know a really good jumping on point other than maybe the Mark Waid, Mike Waringo stuff. That might be a good starting point. The other news I wanted to bring up, Joe, comics are dying. You know that, right?
Yeah, they've been on life support since, when did I start buying? 1977?
Yeah, yeah. Comics are dying. First Second will publish Friends Forever, the third book in the Best Friends graphic memoir trilogy by Shannon Hale and Leun Pham in August of 2021. They have announced a first printing of 1 million copies.
You said that wrong.
1 million.
Amazing.
Real Friends was published in 2017 and Best Friends in 2019. Both were bestsellers, but Friends Forever is a step up when it comes to print runs when it comes out later this year. They'll also have a box set. First Second is a publisher. They started in comic shops, but very quickly moved into bookstores. We get press releases from them because I signed up a long time ago. And a million copy is their highest print run ever. And all they do are graphic novels aimed at young readers. So comics are dying.
Well, they weren't really dead. They're just kind of coughing up blood. And, you know.
I've even had to correct Mike Johnson over at PW Insider who talked about this. It's no, comics aren't dying. Comics have found a new audience. And they're very slowly moving toward that audience. And these smaller publishers, you know, if Marvel was to have a million copy print run of a trade paperback, we would never hear the end of it. But because this is aimed at not superhero fans and not comic book shops, I have to dig this stuff up. So I wanted to point out those two pieces of news, which goes back to what I've been saying about what's happening with comics. They're moving out of comic shops. It's not because they hate comic shops. It's because comic shops have kind of hit this wall. They're not going to grow. It's not a business where you're going to get a whole bunch of new shops.
Do you remember what I called it years ago?
Yeah.
Yep. It's a niche market.
Yep. Speaking of that, wrestling-wise, I don't know if you heard this. WWE has leased their WWE network to Peacock.
So it's not an outright buy.
No, it's they will be on Peacock for the next 5 years. They got a billion for it, a billion over 5 years. And So the WWE Network here in the U.S. is shutting down. They're going to continue the international because they've got, I think the estimates are that they have between 600,000 and 750,000 people. Plus in Canada, it is a cable channel with some cable companies. But WWE is selling off the network. Yes, it could come back in 5 years, but by then Vince will be 81 years old.
And the question I have yet to get answered is, okay, I'm on WWE Network for life. Are they transferring me to Peacock and now I get Peacock for life? Or will it just get canceled and I have to sign up for Peacock? Nobody's addressed that. I've Googled it.
WWE will be shutting down. You will have to, there is a free Peacock, there is a $5 with ads, and there's a $10 without ads.
Yeah, and I think I'm doing $10 for WWE anyway, so to me, it's, and I told my wife, I said, if we don't get it, see, now that's something that I would have thought WWE would have just done, just say, unless you opt out, we will have Peacock automatically transfer you, and for Peacock, I don't know how many WWE users are there.
There's about, it fluctuates between 1.6 and 1.8. Peacock already has between 25 million and 30 million.
Oh, that's so a good ad for them. I mean, all of a sudden, hey, we got a million more people overnight.
So that's not, they're not doing it for the viewers.
No, everybody's doing it for content. That's basically what everything's about. That's why AT&T bought DC. Not to publish DC comics or graphic novels, but to license or make the content.
And also all the pre-existing content. WWE in the press release said they're bringing over 17,000 hours of programs. More and more, they're finding that the more hours of new stuff you have, the more people will stick, the less churn you have. And one of the things, the reason why Netflix shows don't last that long is when they announce the show, that brings people in. But, you know, the fourth season of whatever isn't going to drive new subscriptions. So they've got a different model. With WWE, Peacock is going to be treating it like sports. They get all the pay-per-views. They get, you know, they said that they're going to have one feature documentary a year, but they're also getting, you know, all of the old stuff, but they're also getting NXT, NXT UK, 205 Live, the new India Super Spectacular show. There's also rumors of an NXT Mexico and an NXT Japan. So, it's all about the back catalog in a lot of ways. It's, we need this content. Disney bought Marvel for the content, for all of the characters. And when Stan was trying to sell, you know, movie companies and animation companies on Marvel, that was one of the reasons they created the official handbook of the Marvel Universe. They wanted to actually catalog how many characters do we have, so that they could go to New World Pictures or Universal or and say, we have over 2,500 characters that you could license.
Yeah, I mean,
and it's really clear that Disney is digging in on those if you've watched the latest WandaVision.
Which I haven't. And I told my wife tonight, we got to watch it because I think we're getting close to spoiler territory. I don't think I can wait all eight without some asshole on Facebook going, oh, I can't believe XYZ happened. Thank you.
Well, episode 4 is when the first twist hits. So yeah. Get ready.
And, you know, there are some people, like I saw Peter David mention something. He's smart enough not to spoil it.
Yeah.
You know, which is, I appreciate. But other than that, I gotta get caught up quick.
Well, speaking of getting caught up.
Well, before we do that, we got an anniversary to celebrate.
Oh, we do?
And this will tie into our theme of our show today, because today we're going to do reviews.
Yes.
Corey, and I know you'll remember probably, because what was published 25 years ago? 1986.
That's 35 years ago.
35? I thought they said 25.
1986 was 35 years ago, Joe.
Well, they're talking 25 on the interweb, so they're lying in the
25 years ago.
No, I don't care about that. I only care about 35 because there's a big splash going online about the anniversary of the publication of Kingdom Come.
That was 96, not 86.
Doesn't matter. We're going to talk about it because
you need to apologize.
No, I'm just reading what the interwebs are telling me. You know, they're never wrong.
If they told you that Kingdom Come was published in 1986, Mark Waid had not written a single comic book yet.
No, you just don't want to talk about Kingdom Come. So I'll do it myself because I figured we could give it a review. We'll call it. I was going to make a new section, Retro Reviews. And we could talk about it and then get into the actual comics and stuff that we want to review. Now, Kingdom Come, of course, if you're have never, ever heard of this masterpiece, it's from 1996. It's considered an Elsewhere story, although it did occur on an actual Earth. They numbered it, after DC revamp or what the hell did they call it? Flashpoint? Reborn, whatever. It hasn't been referred to since that, but it's a what if type story. Can we say that, Corey? Of a different version of the DC universe where superheroes, supervillains have become largely indistinguishable from each other. They've grown jaded with power. Heroes have lost any regard for the mere humans they are meant to protect. They fight more than WWE does. An aging pastor is visited by the Spectre and shown that the world is marching towards Armageddon. Superheroes have taken place of gods, and the final battle to usher in Ragnarok is happening. Created by Alex Ross, who is taking the comic world by storm with his super realistic painting style of telling comics. And he went to Mark Waid to help flesh out the storyline. And these two created this masterwork that was only four issues. And it's been in publication ever since. And it's just an amazing story. Did Marvel's or Kingdom Come come first?
Marvel's was first. That was 94.
And that blew everybody away for the same reason.
Yeah. And those two books kind of cemented Alex Ross as a major talent because we'd had painted comics before. Bill Sienkiewicz, very famously in Elektra Assassin, many and many of those pages were painted, but we never had pages painted in a hyper-realistic style. Most of the other paintings were very impressionistic. John J. Muth, Bill Sienkiewicz, Charles Vess, I think. Mark Badger did some painting too, but it wasn't till Alex Ross that we got that very almost Norman Rockwell style of realism with superheroes. He also used specific models for the characters.
And that's something that I wanted to talk about even because the fun thing with Kingdom Come is it had tons of, I guess we call them Easter eggs now.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm looking on page 7 of the first issue and in the bottom, I mean, you talk in the top, there's a long haired Korean man in panel 1, has cigarette dangling from his mouth. He's Sung Koo, a former proprietor of Haley's Comics, a Chicago comic book store that Alex Ross must have gone to because he was from Chicago as well. And then even if you look, there's a damaged car. Or I think the damaged car, the owner looks just like Non, one of the villains from Superman 2. Now, what I loved is you go all the way to the bottom, and every panel's got something cool in that. My favorite is, of course, the appearance of the Monkey Men, but that's way different. But he's walking past a bookshop, and you look inside the window, and you just see all sorts of little things. There's Alternate Egos book by John Law, who was the Golden Age hero, the Tarantula. Behind the Mask by Jesse Chambers, who's daughter of the Golden Age hero Johnny Quick and Liberty Bell, who is in The Flash at the moment that was being published. Under the Hood by Hollis Mason, who is the Golden Age Night Owl from Watchmen. All these fun little Easter eggs, whether you got it or not, they were just that type of love that these guys did. When he goes into, was it Planet Krypton? Is that the name of the...
Which was kind of a superhero version of Planet Hollywood, which I guess doesn't exist anymore.
No. and you got to look. I mean, I love annotated stuff, even like above that, two columns on the same page. You can barely make out who's watching the Watchmen. You know, this was just a labor of love between, well, I know Alex Ross, definitely, because he put so much into it. And this was such a groundbreaking work. If you have yet to buy this, and as you know, Corey and I rate things buy, borrow, or ignore. This one, not only have I bought this, I have this in two versions. Excuse me. I have the absolute version, which allows me to enjoy the art in the expanded absolute style. Mine's a little beat up because my daughters have read it too. No respect for books. I also have the hardcover version that was published as a normal, well, closer to what we consider a trade or graphic novel size, comic book size, because that's the one I pull out almost every year and reread. Because the absolutes are fun, but they're unwieldy. And the nice thing with the absolute, it has a bunch of extra stuff as well. You can also do like I love to do. I tap in Kingdom Come annotations, and I ended up going to AngelaSword.com, who has just wonderful stuff. Half the fun when Kingdom Come came out was just looking at the covers of the comic, because all the different characters were on there, and a lot of them were legacy characters where they were like son and daughter, such and such. And for the most part, we just spent, unless somebody came out and said, oh, yeah, that's such and such, you know, we're all guessing, trying to guess who this was or who they were. And it was just a tremendous series. I remember it coming out, sold crap loads of them. I wish I had it, but I'm pretty sure I ordered this in the hundreds, which, if you recall from the Tales from the Shops, I always gauge things according how I ordered X-Men. I always ordered at least 100 X-Men for the shelf, not counting subscribers. Kingdom Come was similar that way. And then, of course, it came out with what was the name of that company? Graphic Illustrated came out with a red-bound copy with an annotated book attached to it. And then the Absolute came later. But this thing's been in print nonstop. And if you can't find a used copy online, march down to your friendly neighborhood comic shop and just buy one off the shelf. Outstanding reading. As well as Marvel's. If you're not a, I've actually had people read Kingdom Come that weren't DC fans, and a lot of it was like, who are these characters in the background? Says, well, it really doesn't matter. Well, you know, the big ones you'll recognize: Batman, Superman, Wonder Woman. So, Corey, what do you think on Kingdom Come? What is your thoughts on it?
The one thing that really struck me when I read the interview with Mark Waid, the first interview with him after it was done, that was him and Alex Ross's answer to Image. Because at the time, Image were superhero books. They hadn't become kind of what they are now. And those books, if you go back and read them, it's a world where just superheroes are all fighting all the time. They have no personal lives. There are no civilians. It's just, it's a world of superheroes fighting. And Waid and Alex Ross felt that the character is more important than, oh, this guy has cool powers and who's going to win if they fight? It's the character that's more interesting. And if you read Kingdom Come in that light, it really shows the generational difference in comics. There's also just the sheer power of Alex Ross. Now, you know, we're very used to Alex Ross's stuff. But back then, we hadn't seen stuff like that before. We hadn't. So when he did a page, it blew you away because that art style hadn't been used. In a lot of ways, he's like Kirby in that he created a language of comics that didn't exist before he was there. And now, you know, a number of people do highly realistic painted art, and a lot of the coloring in comics uses that Alex Ross style to make even the penciled art seem more painterly. But it was something new. It was groundbreaking, much like Neil Adams, who somebody described Neil Adams when I was younger, and it's always stuck with me. Neil Adams draws people the way they looked if they looked that way. Alex Ross draws superheroes as if they were real. You know, we've gotten into a lot of, in the 80s, there was a, well, superheroes in the real world, and they still would wear the goofy costumes and everything. Alex Ross makes those costumes look cool, and that something a human being would wear. On
no capes.
Top of it, well, no, there were capes. Matter
no
of fact,
capes.
Captain Marvel's costume, the way he does it, is the coolest costume in comics. You know, the button tunic and the way the cape is, so damn cool.
Agreed.
It's so hard for people to kind of grasp the idea of the original Captain Marvel, who I guess they just call Shazam now.
Legally, he's Captain Marvel to us.
But 25 years later, the story still holds up as fresh and new. Because universal truth of these characters.
So what
why
you're saying
is Superman Superman? Why is Batman Batman? Why is Wonder Woman Wonder Woman?
Just borrow it. You would never buy something like this.
I've bought it more than once.
How many different versions do you have?
I think I have three, because I do have the original comics. Then they put out a trade paperback, and it wasn't until later that they put out a hardcover.
Yeah.
And it was kind of an annotated hardcover, so I picked that up.
Yeah, that
so,
was the,
there you go.
That's us off.
We are 30 minutes into this review episode. Well, we've reviewed Kingdom Come. Joe, what other comics have you been reading?
Well, let me start out with a trivia question. Corey, what was the first team up between Spider-Man and Superman? Well, not really a team up, I guess. I guess you could call it that.
Well, there is the very famous tabloid size Superman versus Superman. Was it Superman and Spider-Man, or was it versus Spider-Man?
The first one was a versus.
Okay. And that was the first official team up.
Yes.
However, parody versions of them met in Not Brand X, I do believe.
Yeah. Well, there's actually an earlier one.
Oh?
Yeah. Corey, do you remember the Marvel mini comics?
Yes, I have that box set.
I cracked mine open, and I read it. The first thing you want to do before we get too far, Marvel mini comic books were something that came out in the early 60s, which were, I don't even know if this translates to people. What you'd go to a bubblegum machine.
One of those machines that the vending machines. They
vending,
still have those.
Not quite a vending. Yeah.
With the plastic,
toy.
Container.
Yeah. And you know, at this age, you'd plunk a dime in, you spin this thing, and this bubble would pop out. You open the bubble and you get your little prize. In the 70s, they were still around. I used to drive my mom nuts because I was, could I have a quarter? I want to do this. It's just junk. Yeah. But it was alluring. You'd always see this cool stuff you could get. and you never got the cool stuff. You always got the lame crack. But in the 60s, there was a company, and I'm trying to find what it was called, where they actually published tons of these little things, and they had six mini comics, quite possibly the smallest comics ever published. And inside were original stories. So you'd get these out. They had the Hulk, Spider-Man, the Amazing Spider-Man, Sergeant Nick Fury, Millie the Model, the Mighty Thor, and Sergeant Nick Fury. I had never been aware of these things. I think I started to get aware of them. And if you look on the eBays, they're very hard to find, and some of them are expensive. They're also cheaply made. So if you tried to open them, a lot of times they'd fall apart. So probably not many of them survived. But the publisher, if you pardon me, because I've got all these books, the Abrams Comic Arts and associated with Marvel last year published a complete Marvel Comics in mini book form. And there are six of the comics published, obviously bigger than they were in 1966. But then the first book talks about the history of it by none other than Mark Evanier. And he talks about going all over Hades trying to find these things. He found a machine that was ripping them off because they charged 25 cents instead of a dime. How he would blow anywhere from $5 to $12 on a visit to these particular stores trying to get what he was after. And these particular books, I believe it was a Chicago firm called Creative House Promotions that did them. They weren't all just Marvels. You'd get like Tiny Tales, Monster Laughs, Wise Quacks. Later on, there were Archie comics. There was like All in the Family, that type of. I mean, this was done for quite some time. He was just after the six Marvel because, you know, when you're a kid and you were collecting comics, you wanted a complete collection of this stuff. And he just, the story that Mark weaves is just amazing. He actually shows the different covers. They came in different colors. Sometimes you'd get a copy that might have a wavy cover. They're probably just publishing whatever paper. Towards the end, you could find cake decorations with the books stuck on toothpicks and things like that. And then they just disappeared. And so did a lot of the information, because as you can tell, Mark dug hard and deep and talked with people. A lot of the people who may have worked on these things have passed away. Some of them worked on them that didn't even, they weren't your normal people. They were like, hey, Flo Steinberg, would you do a Millie the Model for us or something? So read the history book first, and then you get an oversized copy of every one. Now, if you crack open the Amazing Spider-Man one, and I read them all, first of all, you get kind of an introduction to Spider-Man. Then there's a little story where Spider-Man ends up surprising some thieves who are busy counting their loot. And so he chases them off. He wraps the jewels in some webbing, and off he went. But the bundle got caught on a flagpole. And along came this fellow in a cape, another superhero. And he saw the loot. He swooped down and grabbed the bundle and didn't even say hi. And he flew off to get all the credit. Spider-Man bemoans as he's watching this caped figure fly away. There's an awful lot of competition among superheroes. That was the official, non-official team-up of Spider-Man, Superman. And the thing is the art is, think of how small the art is. And when you look up the blow-up size, you know, because the comics are about the size of a penny. And, you know, yeah, if you were back then, you knew who he was alluding to. The rest of it was filled with jokes like, hey, Spider-Man, what's this story about you being born in 1843? Yep. A few years later, my parents moved to 1845 next door. The Thor one was a pretty introduction and kind of a story. The Incredible Hulk one was just basically all jokes. Corey, you thought my jokes were bad. You know, it's just like this kid's just annoying to Hulk. Glad to see you're back, Hulk. Yeah, why? I just saw your front. Sergeant Nick Fury was actually more of an actual adventure, which was actually pretty cool. They were out trying to save General Roy Thomas. And the Millie the Model one was a little Millie story.
Roy Thomas.
And the Millie the Model one was a story with Millie the Model. And then, of course, her busy giving, beauty tips, because she says there are no ugly girls, only lazy ones. In today's modern world, anyone can at least be attractive.
There are no ugly girls, just lazy ones. Yeah, that's not a fact at all.
At the bottom of every, at the last page with all the individual, all the information there said, this is a facsimile of a book first published in 1966. The story and art reflects the sensibilities of its time. These are just a fascinating, I didn't even look at the Captain America one because I didn't mention that. Now, same thing. He talks about who Captain America is and, it gives a good little story. I really was going to go hell in high water and try to buy these things because, I was thinking these are fun little books to buy. But some of them pop starting at about $100. Some are lower. But for I think I got this for a while. We talked about it in a previous podcast because they were not only out at Barnes & Noble being discounted for $25, but we bought them through Discount Comic Book Service for about the same price. So obviously, Abrams Comic Art Company had zero faith in this sucker because they just, as far as I knew, this was the first time I'd ever seen them. I've seen these around at different comic stores and out. It's a fun piece of history, and we're all about comic history, as well as probably the best way to collect this at an economical price. I definitely recommend buying it. I know you bought it, Corey.
Yeah. And I would like to point out that it is an incredibly niche product. This is very much a weird little slice of Marvel history. And if you're looking for great stories, you're not going to get them.
Nope. If you're looking for good dad jokes, though, that Hulk one is brilliant.
Evanier does a fantastic job, as always, of researching the history and finding out what's going on. And that's really the reason I bought it, was for his dig into the history of these things. But, when you actually see them, they aren't that great.
Abrams had another one that was canceled right away. It was a similar history book, and I can't remember what it was about.
Marvel Value Stamps.
Oh, I was so onto that.
They say it's coming out later. It is resolicited at a later date. That's one that I'm far more interested in.
Yeah, I'd like
Marvel Value Stamps fascinate me to this day.
Yeah.
Because it was, you sign up for this, and there'll be discounts and specials and et cetera and et cetera. And I can't find anything about, a catalog or anything.
I actually saw some stuff when the Comic-Cons were rolling around. Graham Cracker Comics brought up, it was either a catalog or the book that you put the Marvel stamps in.
Yeah, I've seen the book you put them in.
Yeah, one had the stamps, which is sad because that means some comic somewhere is without them. And
somebody destroyed their Hulk 181.
Yeah. And that's something that's always, you got to be careful when you're buying stuff because there's been times I remember I bought a comic in mint shape only to find out, somebody took out the Marvel Value stamp. But it was weird. Anyways, I'm looking forward to that one too. What you got up on plate, Corey?
The first book I'm reviewing is a book from Image called Rain Like Hammers. It is a one-shot by Brandon Graham, who writes, draws, colors, letters, everything for it. It's a 48-page book. I am unfamiliar with Brandon Graham, but on the back in the back matter, it talks about the other books he did. If you read heavy metal in the 70s and 80s, and got into the Mobius stuff, this is a book that you might enjoy. It is less a story and more a mood piece. It is set in a future with a character who goes to work, watches TV, and observes the world around him. And the art, the creator in the back says it. This came to mind when he was in Vancouver, and the streets were deserted, and it felt like everybody kind of was left alone in their little apartments. The art is interesting. It's some of the pages, like the opening splash page showing the interior of the city, just is this wonderful design that almost looks like what we thought the future would be back in the 70s. That very 70s look of a futuristic world. Plot-wise, there is no real plot. It's more a meditative piece. And if you're looking for a story, there isn't much of one. It's all about mood and the art and the way the story makes you feel. Much like the Mobius stuff, where some Mobius stuff had story and others was, I remember one Mobius story I read where it was just someone walking in the desert for 20 some pages. And it was so well drawn and so interesting that it wasn't till the end where you went, wait, what? Nothing happened. This is kind of the same thing. It's not on that high a level, though. And I would, if you see it in the shop and you're interested in that sort of thing, I would pick it up and give it a flip to see if that's what appeals to you. Because you're not going to get a beginning, middle, and end. The art is also very stylized. It's not hyper-realistic art. It is stylized. The characters give the impression of people instead of being drawn like people. So much is unanswered. It's very much like watching... Joe, do you remember the Spike and Mike Twisted Animation Festival?
That's a brain tickle. I haven't thought of that in years.
But remember, you know, they'd have the cool stuff, and then every so often there would be a cartoon that would just kind of make you go, huh.
I thought that way about The Cat Came Back.
Or the Bill Plimpton stuff that wasn't funny.
Your face is like a song.
It reminds me of the Bill Plimpton stuff that wasn't funny, where it's just doing the art to do the art. On Buy, Borrow, and Ignore, this is a borrow. I can't say that I loved it, but it did what it was supposed to do. It's got a limited audience in my mind because it's going to be for people who want to just kind of feel the mood of this art. It's like when you go to a gallery and you see a painting, and the painting isn't about, oh, this is Bob sitting at a table with Frank and they have flowers and bread. It's more about the mood the painting evokes. And this is very much like that. It's art in that it's going to evoke a mood rather than tell a story. So this is a borrow with, again, a very niche readership. Joe?
I picked this one up at The Source a while back. It's called The Vein, published by Oni Press. Three issues so far. I believe number four is out. I'll have to go run by The Source next couple of days and pick it out. I picked it up primarily because they had a little blurb on it saying this is a local creator. And the writer is Elliot Rowell. Emily Pearson is the artist. I believe Emily is the local part of it. I went into it not knowing what it was because I just bought it because A, I like to support local comic shops. B, I like to support local creators. And she obviously been to The Source because, and I think it was Emily that's the local one. Again, hopefully somebody can correct me if it's wrong. So as I'm reading it, and I'm going to put this out as kind of a quasi spoiler because it's very much a period piece. It's starting out, first of all, in Chicago, Illinois, right before the outbreak of World War II. And we got some bank robbers. They're holding everybody up. They're keeping the guard down. And then one of them says, where do you keep the blood? Right away, Corey, what are you thinking? Who's robbing this place?
Vampires.
Okay, so we got that down. Meanwhile, at the Federal Bureau of Investigations, I don't do Ted very well. You know, meanwhile, at the Hall of Justice, a low-level agent is trying to meet with Hoover because he has this weird thing about how these different places across the country are being robbed only of their blood, but there's way too many of them to make it just a coincidence. And while Edgar's not impressed, he says, go ahead, lead a preliminary field investigation. I expect results. The story keeps flipping back and forth between the robbery and the meeting because they're probably going on simultaneously. And what really gets things going is when that final robbery occurs, it was so public that it got Hoover's attention that, yeah, something's here. And the final issue ends with the vampires. They've realized they've gone a little too far. They've broken up. They finally get together in Vegas. And while they're trying to plan their next heist because they're getting low on blood, World War II takes off. And not only does the agent get reassigned and drafted, but all of a sudden on Edgar's desk, these vampires show up and say, what's the meaning of all this? Who are you people? I thought it was obvious. We're vampires. We want to kill some Nazis. And then from there, it goes on. And then the second issue and the third issue occurs after the war. And the agent and the vampires keep crossing paths, but they're just not quite there yet. I enjoyed these first three issues enough. I'm going to buy the third one. The story was compelling. And again, I rarely do I get to go into a book not knowing what the hell's going on, because I don't usually, if I buy something, it's because we've recommended it on our previews episode. I've seen previews or Corey has mentioned something about it or whatever. And so to go into a book, and I wish I had more money to do this, without knowing what was going on, was a joy. And just to be tricked and teased and nodded and prodded in the right direction. And then again, when I got to the first issue, I was hoping it'd be a hook to keep me going, especially since I got issue 2 and 3. The key would be issue 4. And I don't know if this is an ongoing or a regular series. The way it's pacing, it sounds like it'll probably be a regular series, because eventually they're going to meet and there's going to have to be a conclusion between what the investigator is doing and what the vampires are doing. And I've just enjoyed it. The fact that it's a local connection, it makes it even more of a joy. So if you get a chance, I would say definitely if you see it on the racks, pick them up if you're lucky enough to get all 4 issues. My guess would be Oni will probably publish it in a book. Hard to say. I don't know how it's selling. But definitely this one was a buy for me. Mr. Strode, what you got next?
I have the first 5 issues of Buffy the Vampire Slayer from Boom. It is the new Buffy series, unlike the Dark Horse series. It is written by Jordi Belair, drawn by Dan Mora, and I have read the first 5 issues. What it is, it takes us all the way back to when Buffy first showed up in Sunnydale. She is working at a fast food place, slaying vampires. She meets Xander and Willow for the first time. We meet Cordelia for the first time. It is almost a reboot. Here is the problem that I have, first off. The people who are going to buy this are people who are already fans of Buffy the Vampire Slayer. They do not set this up to be for new readers. You know, people who don't already know the property. So most of the people who are going to pick this up are fans, and they make a lot of changes to the events that have occurred, the order in which they occurred, how characters meet each other, and actually two parts of the characters. But it doesn't enhance the story. One of the things that Joss Whedon did, you know, there was the Buffy the Vampire Slayer movie. Then when he did the TV series, he kind of treated the movie as if it didn't exist and rewrote it to make it more what he wanted. Basically, he was able to get a reset so that he could start anew. This is another case of starting anew. So we're getting the beginning of the story for the third time without anything new and interesting, just kind of some minor tweaks here and there. And it's well done. Yeah, the story is well written. The art is very good. The action is well choreographed. But at the end of the day, this feels very unnecessary. It doesn't bring anything new to the story. It doesn't bring anything new to the party. Dark Horse had kind of two phases of Buffy the Vampire Slayer. First was kind of TV tie-in, where it's, okay, we're going to tell stories that happen in and around what happened in the show. And, you know, they're almost like throwaways. They're extras, kind of like the way the Star Trek novels used to be, or even the Star Trek comic used to be. Then they did kind of a reset where it's, okay, now that Buffy's been gone for a while, we're going to do the next season, season 8, season 9, season 10, season 11. We're going to continue the story because there's not going to be any more Buffy the Vampire Slayer TV series. We're not going to do a continuing movie. We're just going to continue the story. Kind of like what the Star Trek novels did after Nemesis, where it's okay, if nobody's going to play with this, we're going to. And they had Joss Whedon working on it. Now, this is kind of a going back to the beginning again. And for me, it just doesn't work. It's not like you can't find the TV series. It's running on two different cable channels, a streaming service, and the DVDs you could get anywhere. The Dark Horse, where they continued the story on when it started, was crazy hot. By the time it ended, it had pretty much, you know, petered out. But I remember when it first started coming out, Dreamhaven, if it was delayed for a week, Dreamhaven would actually send an email and put a notice on their webpage. Buffy the Vampire Slayer is delayed for a week. It's not coming in this week. To just warn people, because they had so many people who were coming in just for that. I can't see people doing it for this. Maybe in the future it goes off in other directions and feels more unique than it does. But it kind of feels like leftovers. And for this, I'm going to rate it an ignore. Joe?
How many more you want to do here?
Oh, let's see how much time we've... Oh, we're already at an hour, so you want to finish up or should I?
All right, I'll finish up. I got one more, and then do you want to do one more?
Nah, we don't want to go for... We're doing previews next week, so I doubt we want to go real long.
Okay.
Just think, we're doing previews and then the 500th episode.
Ooh, that should be fun.
Yeah.
Let's see. I suppose
I'm doing for it. Yeah.
It's what? Time for kids. Have your parents leave the room, okay? This is just for kids. We're going to interview a book just for kids. So we'll take a few minutes. Okay, all the kids out of the room? Oh, good. Because I'm going to talk about a book from Humanoids Press. Gullivera by Milno Manares. And if you don't know who that is, well, he's a monumental master comic artist of uncommon ability, a master of line work and layout whose storytelling chops deserve to be mentioned in the same breath as those as Kirby, Crumb, Toth, and Mobius, so says ComicAlliance.com. If you know Gullivera, you probably thought, wait, isn't that Gulliver of Gulliver Travels? Why, yes, it is. Milo takes the story, and I think this was published originally, if you want to hold on a second. Originally published in French by Les Humanoïdes Associates in Paris.
Ah, the Humanoïdes Press.
Yes. And it's a huge, it's basically, I'm trying to think of the size of it. It's almost magazine size, hardcover book. And of course, you can tell in the cover, she's barely wearing something, using a pirate hat to cover up her hoo-ha with a bunch of tiny people around her. Now, if you remember The Adventure of Gulliver's Travel, and I don't know why we're talking about a story by Jonathan Swift. He talks about his adventure where he ends up in a land where he is the largest creature around. It starts out, of course, by them trying to bind him down to a beach, and he breaks free. He helps him out. As he leaves, his boat takes him to an area where he is the smallest creature around. And and the shenanigans in tail. Now, imagine if you're a very voluptuous, well-drawn woman, and this same type of stuff starts happening. I mean, it did start out that she's traveling. No, she was just out on a raft, sunbathing in the nude, and a wave knocked her off her raft, took away her suit, and she ends up on this strange ship that's been moored offshore. Well, she climbs aboard and finds a copy of Gulliver's Travel, and a storm breaks up, washes her ashore, and next thing she knows, she is waking up, and she can barely move because all these little people have tied her down, spread eagle, and she's trying to get up, and they're shooting spears at her, and so on. Yes, how would you call this? More of a titillating type tale, taking I wouldn't say X-rated. I would say definitely a hard R turn into this poor girl reenacting Gulliver's travels. I mean, when she's there and they're doing a military parade, all the she has to stand basically spread eagle over the crowd with the king telling if any men look up, they're going to have their eyes plucked out. And if you don't know why, you probably shouldn't be reading this book to begin with. And the art is a delight. I mean, Milo Manara is just amazing with the art. This has more of a European sensibility to it because it was originally published there. I thought originally it was from Heavy Metal, but I know he must have had stuff done by Heavy Metal because the art is very recognizable. Eventually, she does find her way home. Not after stopping off at an island that floats where apparently the women are awake and horny during the day because they sleep at night when the men are awake and just spend all their time looking at stars. There's obviously some disconnect there because she happens to end up when the women are there and shenanigans occur. I bought this. I don't know when I bought this thing. Let's see when the publishing date was. And it comes shrink wrapped, so you can't browse it. This was they published this 2016. So it tells you how long this has been sitting in my collection waiting to be read. I found it fun. You know, it could be a fun Skinamax type jaunt if they ever wanted to make it into a movie. Sex is played up as part of the story. Obviously, there's every so often you get that American sensibility where, like, as they're dragging her prone body to the king, one of the ma has to yell at the little kids because they're busy playing in her pubic hair. But if that doesn't bother you, I recommend go check it out. Have you, Corey, run across any of art from Milo like this?
Yes, I remember reading a couple of his books back in the 90s. And his stuff is European softcore. Lots of nudity, lots of implied sex, beautiful art, just beautiful art. No story whatsoever to speak of most of the time.
Yeah. I said this one, they just ape Gulliver's Travel.
Yeah, most of his stuff, that I read was first in heavy metal, and then Humanoids Press would print it in what they called albums, which were a lot like those Marvel graphic novels of the 80s, where, you know, it's larger size, 48 to 64 pages. Those are kind of the European graphic novels of the time as well. Definitely for a mature audience. And when he draws covers here in the U.S., it's funny how people just completely lost their minds with the covers yeah. he did. Whereas over in Europe, he's been drawing that stuff for 30 years and nobody cares. So,
kids, it's okay. Tell your parents they can come back in the room now.
Okay. You know who does care about our listeners?
My aunts.
And these guys, our sponsors. Believe it or not, kids, this here podcast has sponsors. And that sponsor, since day one, is DreamHost.com. DreamHost.com is the best, bar none, web host in the whole known universe. And if you need a website, head on over to DreamHost.com, put in code CRAZY, that's K-R-A-Y-Z, and get $20 off your first year. Now, if you would like to advertise here on any of the Solitaire Rose Network podcasts, you can. Just email me at solitairerosenetwork@gmail.com, subject advertising. Also, head on over to eBay and look for user Crazy, K-R-A-Y-Z, that's Joe Crazy Writer, who's always telling us about the eBay in every episode of Crazy Comics and Stories. If you would like to contact us, you can do so. You can give us a call at 952-856-0519. Leave a message and we'll play it on the show. Or you can send us an email at solitairerosenetwork@gmail.com. Thanks. Now, I'm starting to crank up some of the podcasts again, especially the stuff I do over PWInsiderElite.com. I do podcasts there every week about all Elite Wrestling with Anthony Pyrus. But I also do all of these. The Solitaire Rose Radio Network is currently on a pause, basically because COVID-19 has made it so that I have to work a lot of extra hours at both jobs. But you can still go and listen to my other podcasts. Now, you're probably listening to Crazy Comics and Stories, which is the main podcast. But on this same feed, K-R-A-Y-Z-C-O-M-I-X, is Solitaire Rose Radio, the solo radio podcast that I do. I've done interviews, I've done short stories, I've done all sorts of things, and you can get to it right here on this same feed. I also do a podcast called Novelcast, where I take the novels I've written and turn them into free audiobooks. That's over at novels.solitairerose.com. Dangerous Dan Moore and I, and of course Wolfie B. Bad, give you bad advice over at badadvice.solitairerose.com. You send in your questions, and we give you the aforementioned bad advice. And then myself and Adam Vermillion from For the Love of Comics do the Fantastic Forecast at fantasticforecast.solitairerose.com, where we go through the issues of the Fantastic Four, four issues at a time, to give the plot and commentary on each issue. That's not all. Yes, I'm crazy. I still, over at PWInsiderElite.com, every week on Wednesday, do a recap of the latest episode of AEW Dynamite. I write up what happened, and then myself and Anthony Pyrus will do an audio. Now, you can only listen to the audio, if you remember, at PWInsiderElite.com, and if you're a wrestling fan, you should be, where we then break down the episode, talk about what we liked, what we didn't like, give it a grade, and let you know if you should have watched that episode. Those are the other podcasts here at the Solitaire Rose Radio Network. Thanks. And if you think Joe is just kind of sitting around on his sun porch, napping away with a comic book in his lap, and when his wife comes out, he kind of wakes up and, oh, I'm reading. I'm sorry, I can't.
It's for the podcast. I have to read it.
Joe, he also does what's going on the eBays. Joe?
Yeah. No, well, Corey, I got bad news.
Oh, no. Sad news, everyone. Sad news.
Well, sad or bad, either way. I sold your favorite copy of Tarot, Witch of the Black Rose, number 53.
Ah!
Yep, it didn't last long, because you know I always...
The famous, your vagina is haunted!
And I did take a scan of that page, so if you folks want to see it, just send me a quick email, and I'll let you see it, rather than you going out and finding a copy of number 53. If you remember, I did a quick review of it on one of our review shows, and Tarot, if you don't mind getting past Jim Ballant's affinity for drawing large-chested and beautiful women, it's really a horrific story. I mean, he's doing titillating horror books.
Actually, that's a great issue. My favorite issue is actually issue number 59, which has a guest appearance by dancer, actress, director, writer, and creature on Who Wants to Be a Superhero, Tanya Kaye. She is in issue 59.
Hang on, I got to write that down. I'll have to look for that one. Number 59. Damn, 10 issues short. I talked earlier about I bought a copy from Granite City Hellblazer, number 27. That's the Neil Gaiman, Dave McKean issue that he did. That's incredible if you get a chance to buy one. The reason I sold it, the one I got from Tim was in nicer shape than the one I had in my collection. So I sold off the one in my collection. I have a number of issues of Naughty Bits online. Naughty Bits was a series done by alternative cartoonist Roberta Gregory, where she takes on all comers. It was a quarterly book published by Fangraphics from 91 to 99. It can be very funny. There's an ongoing escapades of Bitchy Bitch and Bitchy Butch. Bitchy Butch was a super nasty lesbian who takes negative thinking to the extreme. Bitchy Bitch was just a woman trying to get through life. And the series was amazing. It's one of those, I kept the issues I liked, and the other ones I have are out on the eBays. Later issues are very expensive, but later I'll tell you what you can do if you see one you want and you want it a little less. The one I sold was number 12. Actually, I sold two, number 12, and I didn't write down the other one. I sold a copy of Plastic Man Archives, Volume 2, hardcover. This one was a little beat up, but I read through it. I enjoyed it, but... much like my old partner, Pat Gruber, it didn't make the cut for things I want to keep. And, Corey, you've got DC Archives. Are these issues on DC Archives, the online service?
Which ones?
This was Plastic Man Archives, so it would have been reprinting Police Comics.
I do not know. I have not looked. However,
all the Jack Cole stuff.
I will let you know something about those. They're all in public domain.
Oh, wow.
So you can go read them out on the public domain sites.
Okay. Because I know the books are really expensive.
Yeah.
I mean, DC must have killed the whole archive edition where Marvel's keeping theirs alive.
What was funny about that, 10 years ago, those Plastic Man archives, I filled in my collection because there were online sites selling them for $10 each.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And I remember...
And then the minute they go out of print, boom.
And I remember having all of these things because when I closed Crazy Comics, first of all, when I closed Hot Comics, I kept all the Masterworks, all the Plastic Men. And believe me, when you had all the archives, I should say, DC Archives, and when you have them up on a shelf lined up, they were beautiful. And then over time, I think I kept Supergirl, I kept All-Star, and I started reading some of these, and while the Jack Cole stuff is fun, some of that stuff, that Silver Age is just, it's better remembered than it is reading.
Oh, yeah.
Like you said, the prices went up. I brought them to Crazy Comics. I brought them back, and they've since disappeared on the eBay. So I still think I have a number. If you're interested, I still got a number 1 and a number 6. Again, they're pricey, but I've got the cheapest one on the internet. So... And I'll tell you how you can get it cheaper if you want. I sold a quick run of X-Men True Friends from Marvel 1999. Chris Claremont came back, did a quick series starring Shadowcat, Wolverine, and Phoenix. Phoenix being Rachel from another dimension, whatever. This was back when Marvel had an annoying habit of making There are miniseries, only three issues. Corey, could you tell the good readers why, as a retail, this is annoying as hell?
Because by the time the first issue comes out, you've already ordered all three issues. So you have no idea if it's going to sell or not. With a four-issue miniseries, you're ordering the fourth issue when the first issue's out. So you can kind of see if they're stacking up on your shelves or people are buying them. Now, I don't know about final cutoff orders then.
No, there were no such thing.
But I do know now that you can raise your order, and I think you can drop your order with the final order cutoff, which is basically the Friday before they go to print, you can make changes.
Yeah, back then, the only time you'd get to change something is if they knew in advance it was late, missolicited, or whatever. And sometimes DC was real good at it. Marvel, at this point, I believe, was bankrupt or coming out of bankruptcy. Marvel was terrible at it. So obviously some brain trust came up and said, you know, we could trick these guys and just have them order all three, and then they can't do anything about it. And the other thing that was bad was sometimes issue ones would sell out. Nobody would come back to issue twos or threes, which is always weird to me when you're doing a miniseries. I guess as a buyer, it makes sense. But again, years ago when I was buying stuff, and my retailer, John Nunziata, told me, if it's a miniseries, buy all four because you have an easier time getting rid of them. Well, I finally got rid of them. I've been holding on to this from 1999. If this was any good, I have no idea because I didn't bother reading it. Or if I did, I totally blanked on it.
You know the other weird thing about the three-issue miniseries? You could tell it's before they would think miniseries goes into a trade, because a trade of just a little over 70 pages, no, nobody's going to buy that.
No.
No one's going to buy it. So they were very much just, okay, it's Chris Claremont doing a Wolverine story. Actually, he wants to do a Kitty Pryde, Rachel Gray story, but put Wolverine in it so it'll sell.
Yeah. Let's see. A couple of single issues. DC Special number 4 from 1969. 13 shock ending stories. It was a fun read, but again. Spitfire number 1 from 2010, which was a one-shot. Marvel was doing a Women of Marvel, a bunch of different characters. I think Gamora was one of them. I don't remember. I've sold them all. Another copy of Fantasy Masterpiece number 7 from 1966, where Marvel was reprinting their Golden Age books. These are just low copy books that I pick up as when Corey and I go out geeking. I have no idea if I have them or not. I just buy them because if I don't, it's fun reading. If I do, I just go on eBay's. A random copy, X-Men, Uncanny X-Men number 514. This was the Simon Bianchi variant cover. This was going on during Utopia, which was, I believe, Uncanny X-Men versus Dark Avengers storyline. The final book I sold was Cry for Dawn number 9, back when Joe Monks and Joseph Michael Linsner were together, from 1992. I believe it was a first print. This is the good one where Dawn is almost totally naked with the banner across her breast. This image offends women. Mine was a fine copy, had a big ding on the side, but you know, I grade them accordingly. I price them accordingly. I try to keep them cheap accordingly. But as you, the listener of the shows, know, if you see something you want, and despite all my health troubles, I've been still putting stuff up on eBay. You see something you want, just send me a quick note. What you do is you click on the item you're interested in, and on the side, we'll have a little thing that says contact seller. Contact the seller. That's me. Tell me, hey, love the show. I'm interested in this item. Could you do me a deal on it? And you know damn well I will. I ship everything for free. I give you a free key to the Strode compound. And
wait,
if I
wait,
know,
what?
No, I meant to say I was going to put issues of the Weekly World News book that you and Dangerous Dan Moore did. He
Grandpa
doesn't know where
Dan Moore.
Grandpa Dan Moore. He is. He doesn't know where he put them. I told him I wanted to just buy them all and distribute them for fun. And I don't know where they are. Here I thought, you know, I was going to help him out, give him his money back for what he paid on these things, because he never even gave you any copies, did he?
No.
So I've got mine, personal one that was signed by both these chuckleheads, and I don't believe it was in the same spot. But regardless, I'll always have something fun for listeners to our show. All you got to do is check me out on eBay, K-R-A-Y-Z. And like I say always, even though my voice is almost gone, come get some!
And now we get to my favorite part of the show.
Oh, where we do a vocal recording of our enactment of 9.5 weeks?
No, I was going to say that it's where you sing the Brady Bunch song, "When It's Time to Change, You've Got to Rearrange."
Sugar, la la la, I think I love you.
That's the Partridge Family.
Oh, they're all a blur.
You were supposed to do the Peter Brady part. Remember the episode where his voice was changing? So they made a song about it, and
Peter's got pubes. Yeah, I remember that one. Maybe I was watching a different Brady Brunch than you were.
Now it's time for Freaking and Geeking. Joe, what are you freaking on?
That I can't find my Freaking and Geeking list. Hang on a second. Ah, here it is. I'm going to save my health because I've got some freaking, some geeking on it. But mostly geeking, because if you remember last episode, I'm feeling much better now. I am freaking, though. There's a book coming out. And I wrote down the quarter. It's a Stan Lee book. Do you remember the title, Corey?
Stan Lee, The Rise and Fall? Something like that.
No, it's... Hang on a second. I took a screenshot of it. Let's see if I can find it in all my goofy pictures. Nope, I might have erased. Oh, there it is. True Believers.
That's it.
Yeah, Rob Selkowitz. Whatever. If you're out there, Rob, give us a call. We'll interview you on this show for it. But boy, I swear, anything that this book basically concentrates on Stan Lee after he left Marvel, which apparently is a portion of his history that isn't well documented, other than the fact that Stan made a lot of spectacular mistakes, may have been taken advantage of. We just don't know. I did hear, and I think through you, Corey, that Roy Thomas was involved.
Yes, Thomas was interviewed for it.
I don't know how those interviews were used, because right now people are breaking into their normal camp. Stan Lee's an overhyped shyster. We all know that Ditko and Kirby did everything versus, well, no, they didn't. And we've talked about it ad nauseum, so I don't even want to go down that argument. But, man, it's like you can't even mention Stan Lee without these people freaking. I'm curious on it. I've also heard people say where Rob's just written hatchet books. I have no idea. I'm waiting to see what Roy says. He's allegedly getting an advanced copy of it, or he should be. And it's just something I am interested in, even if it's negative to light. You know, Stan the man was a man. He was human. Even he admits, you know, his memory's not as good. You know, people always bring up, well, Kirby said that he said everything and Stan did nothing. And I'm like, yeah, well, Kirby was very mad and bitter at the way he was treated by Marvel.
And that was an interview. Most of that came out in an interview with Gary Groth, where Gary was just, if you've listened to the interview, Gary was goading him a bit. And there was, Stan and Jack had issues going all the way back to Stan being an errand boy at Marvel, and Joe
Just
Simon.
He was thinking, a nephew Martin.
What it is, Joe Simon and Jack Kirby felt they were getting ripped off. They were supposed to get royalties on Captain America, and they felt that the book was selling far better than what Martin Goodman was telling them. So they were moonlighting, basically, for DC. Martin Goodman found out they were moonlighting for DC. Simon and Kirby always thought it was Jack Kirby who squealed on him. Stan always said that he had nothing to do with it. He had no idea they were working outside of Marvel. We'll never know. Some of Jack's stories are just could not have happened time-wise, because he said when he left DC, he came over to Marvel, and at Marvel they were moving out the furniture, and I told Stan, no, I'll save the company. Well, no, they weren't moving out the furniture because they actually had signed a deal with Independent News, which was owned by DC, which was National Periodical Publications, to continue distributing. And the deal was that they would get 8 books a month. And Martin Goodman was always looking for a way to squeeze more in because they were profitable. And, you know, there are tons of stories like that. And I always go back to the story that John Romita tells. There was one night where he hitched a ride home. You know, Jack had come in to drop off his art. Rather than take the train home, Stan said, "Oh, I live out there. I'll take you home." John Romita went with them. They were Stan and Jack were in the front of the car talking. Romita was in the back. And he said, Stan would say a bunch of stuff. Jack would say a bunch of stuff. And it was clear they weren't listening to each other at all. They were just talking. You know, Stan was talking about, oh, in the next issue of the Fantastic Four, we should do blah, 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 blah. And Jack would be, well, I think in the next issue of the Fantastic Four, I'm going to do da, 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 da. And John Romita said, neither one knew, you know, neither one kind of grasped what the other was saying. And if they would have left, they would have had completely different stories about what they discussed. That's how I think it is. Stan was an editor who had to write because Martin Goodman was so goddamn cheap, he wouldn't let Stan hire writers.
Nobody ever.
Maybe his brother and Robert Beerbohm, who kind of was, he helped out, but he was able to, he took the lowest rate possible. And once Marvel started selling, he was kind of shuffled out the door.
And see, that's the thing that kills me. Nobody ever gives shade to Martin. They just, it's something about these Kirby followers. It just, they want to just totally eviscerate anything Stan did. And we've talked about it in past. And again, I don't want to get too far into it. I call it the John Lennon, Paul McCartney phenomenon. They did much better stuff together than they did solo, even though they did good solo stuff. And you've been... I don't know. You've jumped on Kirby boards more than I have. If somebody says
it's awful, it's awful.
If somebody brings that up and says, "Hey, his Fourth World were great concepts but unreadable," you get forced off the board. You know, this is like just a cultish type following that is. I don't know. I just every time I see it raise its head, and again, I've seen people going off and it's just all they're doing is talking about a book that's not even published yet. I think you would think all these anti-Kirby people would be busy, you know, having fun in their showers with the ads for this book. Anyways, the book's coming out sometime in February. I haven't ordered it yet, although I will probably pick it up because I want to know. You know, it's not going to stop me from loving Stan or Jack or Steve any more than I already do.
One thing I want to point out, you talked about it was like Lennon and McCartney. There is one major difference with Lennon and McCartney. They've both done issues at the time, done interviews where they've said, Paul wrote this, John wrote this.
Yeah.
Paul wrote this part. John came in and added this part. You know, they were very good about knowing who did what, because when they, you know, think about it, you're like in your early 20s and all of a sudden you are the most famous people in the world. You're going to remember your process of writing songs. At Marvel, these were basically office jobs.
Yeah.
I remember talking to Kurt Swan at the bar after the convention he was at. And he was talking about how, you know, people ask where this came from, where that came from, why I did this, why I did that. You know why I took the job? Because I like drawing. I could get done by noon and go bowling. I don't remember any of the stories. I don't remember the stories.
I can go bowling. It's kind of like Shatner talking about his early stuff. He said, I don't remember this stuff. I had to move on to the next job.
It would be like you coming to me and go, Corey, you remember back in 1994 when you were working for BI, you put together this Excel spreadsheet. What was going through your mind while you did it? And my answer would probably be, whatever I was listening to on the radio. To them, a lot of this stuff was, it was a job. You don't remember individual. Now, there are some guys who do. Gene Colan remembered all of it because Gene Colan was a very different artist at the time. But there are lots of artists who, yeah, it was a job. They gave me a script and I drew it.
And, you know, nobody gives Stan credit. He largely, speaking of credits, was the one that started giving credits to people.
Exactly.
But whatever. That, you know, I'm freaking on just the negativity of that. That's pretty much it for me on freaking. Corey, how about you? What you freaking on?
Box Day came this week, and because it's that time of year, this is a time when not as many books come out. It was the smallest box I've gotten in a long time. Joe, do you remember the little diamond boxes where it would be the diamond box inside the big box?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That's all I got. And it was kind of, oh, it's Box Day, and okay. And I, except for the omnibus I'm going to talk about in Geeking, I've read most everything already. Thankfully, Box Day was Thursday. So Thursday night, I'm going to go to bed and read comic books. And then Friday, it's like, okay, I'm done with work. I'm going to read comic books. So, and I read stuff for, you know, this. But kind of a slow week, well, slow month. And you know what that means. If it's a slow month for Joe and I, that means it's a real slow month for comic shops. January, February, March are usually their slowest times. So if you're listening to this, help out your local comic shop. When you go in to pick up your stuff, throw in an extra graphic novel. Throw in a few extra books that you hadn't thought of. Go dig in the, you know, there. I think Mind's Eye has that thing that has all of the DC 100 pagers. Go through, pick up a bunch of those. Those are good. You know, pick up some just reading stuff. You know, not collecting stuff, just reading stuff. Help out your comic shop in this time when it's, you know, just because there isn't as much coming out doesn't mean the rent goes down, doesn't mean the heat's going to cost less, doesn't mean the lights are going to be less. So help out your local shop. Joe, what you geeking on?
Talking health-wise, oh, my God, what a switch from last week to this week. Last week, I couldn't move. I was in nonstop pain, hard sleeping. Well, I did get into the doctor. Most of what happened was because of a insurance fucking up. I mean, I have it so when my pills have run out, I can order my new pills. I go through Walgreens. They're usually, Walgreens is great because not only are they open Saturday, Sunday, so I can, like today, I can go down and get my drugs, but I can also order 24/7 whenever I need to. But the problem is because it's not part of Health Partners who I get my health care through. Health Partners used to have their own pharmacy, so they'd be like, we have to get an order, we have to get an okay. So they just email the doctor. Well, now they're outside the system, so they have to fax it over. Well, then the doctor doesn't get the fax until he comes into his office. Now, he's going to different clinics. So what usually takes anywhere 24 to 40 hours sometimes takes a week. Well, I hit that weird sweet spot where both my drugs to keep my rheumatoid arthritis in check ended. The one disappeared off into a netherland. I never got filled. The other one, that I sent it off when I take my pills on Sunday. Friday, I get a call. Oh, well, before the doctor can approve it, we need to get blood work done, which is fine. These drugs have the possibility of really effing up my liver. So what ends up happening is I do the blood test the following Monday. He gets the results Tuesday. The drugs get shipped out Wednesday. I can't pick them up till Thursday. 2 weeks, bam, hit me like a goddamn freight truck. And that's where I was last week. And it was so hard, so severe. When I finally did see the doctor, you know, he was very sorry what happened. The drugs are reordered. I got two batch of the first one. The second one I haven't heard from yet. But what really helped is they gave me steroids. trying to think of the name of it. It starts with a P.
Pedrosone?
Yes, thank you. Same thing I had when I had the pneumonia back. And it almost immediately gave me relief within hours. The first one was a shot. I mean, and I got, when I got home, and I'm only like 20 minutes from the clinic, I could feel it because I could actually walk without feeling like it'd be easier just lay down and just not move. Although laying down hurt. I could start getting up without, oh my God, that's killing me. And I had the first decent night's sleep that I ever had in 2 weeks. Finally, the pills came, more of the same. It's one of those, you take four tablets for the first week, 3, 2, 1, and finally 4 weeks. The bad side of it is, well, first of all, I should say I feel good. I mean, my voice is still creaky. Where last week, everything hurt on me. Right now, elbows, shoulders, and one thumb are just achy. Everything else I can move with a little creakiness. And I got to say, the weird thing about this, oxycodone didn't help the pain. I had a batch left from when my hip, and I thought, I need to sleep. So I took it, did not help. I mean, I felt like that momentary high you get if you've ever taken it. I felt it for 10 minutes, but the pain never went away. Well, this is helping the pain. Still not on the drug I need, but I can move. I feel much better now. And, oh, I just thank everybody. I know Corey ate a couple extra pies for me. I do appreciate that, mainly because the flip side of being on this particular steroid is that it's really going to F up my blood sugar. I can tell already because my eyesight's changing a little bit. I got to watch out for simple carbs. Unfortunately, that's 90% of my the way I keep everything. You know, I just have this many carbs. Well, now that has an extra effect. So I'm not out of the woods. I got a week to do. I am getting some hand function left. And as you know, I still got to do that damn TSA test whenever I can get back. Fortunately, they're like, well, yeah, get yourself better. I haven't been to work in like, well, I did go to a training session for 3 days this week, which was fine because all I did was sit and be miserable. But it was online death by PowerPoint. I thought death by PowerPoint was bad. Oh, Corey, I don't know. Have you done virtual online death by PowerPoint?
Oh, yeah.
Holy moly. Oh, you were able to do it at home, though, right?
I even had to try to teach people
by
PowerPoint over the internet and everything. And, I could say this. It was unbelievably clear that neither of them were paying any attention at all. To the point where it would be, I would ask a question and wait. Wait. And then I would just go on. And then they put the people on the phone the next week. They were asking me basic questions that I'd gone over in incredible detail. And I just had to message the supervisor, go, yeah, they're asking me all the stuff that I spent a week training them on.
Yeah. Well, this was a little different because while we could have done it at home, we couldn't because it's this SSI, you know, we're talking about the TSA playbook that, you know, you can figure out if you travel, but I just can't say, hey, yeah, this is what we do. Plus, they also had, the nice thing is they didn't have a lot of role playing. The flip side was this would have been one of those travel deals where I would have gotten to travel somewhere, which I don't mind doing, because then I could have brought you like, hey, here's what I did on the weekend when I visited the comic stores. I also, he kind of watched and helped. You know, I got on there and I couldn't get my sound going and things like that. So, but it was something I had to do and it's over with. And I'm glad I got that done. So, like I said, health wise, I'm doing better, which is nice because in a couple weeks, we're a weekend of my birthday, I'm heading up north again. So hopefully if I time it right, I'll have another get to visit Collector's Connection again and see what's going on. Maybe get some good stuff. Speaking of other geeking, again, that was kind of a freaking geeking. And when you deal with your health, it almost always is. Babylon 5 is now on HBO Max. And as you know, I've been trying for years to get my wife to try this. And she is so spectacularly noncommittal, which is weird because I come home and find her watching like Buffy or watching Supernatural. And I'm like, hey, I'd watch these with you, but you're already done with them. Or she'll find something else. There's so much with all the streaming channels. And I hear about, oh, you should try this and you should try that. I've got to watch WandaVision. Wait, is that what it's called? Yeah, WandaVision.
Yep.
And because like we were talking, I think, off camera, off potting, microphone, whatever. You know, episode 4 had such a twist that I'm scared someone's going to just mention it by accident on their Facebook. So I just want to get caught up. I was going to wait till all 8 issues. You know what I'm talking about. We're out. But anyways, Babylon 5, I'm going to wade through season 1. It's not as bad as people say. It's just when you start getting into the roller coaster issues or episodes where, you know, it ends and you're like, oh, my God, I got to wait a week. Well, now you don't have to wait a week. And I do recommend giving it a shot. And now that it's on B5, is on HBO Max, you can. We did watch a couple other movies, though. Oh, that's what when I was up suffering and not unable to sleep. I got into the first movie, which was the TNT version where they remastered it before they took over. And then the first episode, it's a lot of fun. Last night we kind of slipped and paid homage to the other king. And of course I'm talking Elvis. First one was, and again, my wife found this, I think these were HBO Max. She was just looking through finding things. Elvis, That's the Way It Is. This is a documentary doing the behind the scenes outtakes and practices of Elvis when he opened up in Vegas, which was a really big deal because they had a little bit in the beginning where people were filtering in and you would see like there's Sammy Davis Jr. There's Anne Margaret coming in. And then they, out of 6 shows, they compiled the entire act. And it was a fun hour just watching him. You know, he's singing one of his ballads. And then, of course, he reaches on the audience and he's stopping to kiss women. He's shaking hands and the women are freaking out. I love you, Elvis. Come on. And he talks to this one woman. Hey, you want to start something? He goes, of course I do. And a big hug. And just a lot of fun. So naturally, because I had never seen it, my wife had never seen it, we decided to watch Viva Las Vegas, which was Elvis and Anne Margaret in their only movie together, which was really too bad because this was, yeah, it was schmaltzy. Some of the music was contrived. You know, it's one of those where they randomly break into music depending on what's going on. There was a couple spots in it where Elvis had some really, really funny comedic timing. You know, and of course it's a love triangle and he basically is losing to his much richer rival, but he's working as a maitre d', as basically a food server at one of these posh restaurants. So he discovers that Anne Margaret and his rival are in the rival's room having what should be a romantic dinner. Well, he arranges to be the guy to serve him the food. Oh my God, just hilarious. When we finished, of course, my wife was busy reading the Wikipedia page. She said there were a couple things that were interesting about this. Colonel Parker did not like the fact that Anne Margaret had equal time with Elvis. And he was on the set demanding that she be cut. He wanted more Elvis. Well, he was basically booted off the set, which is why he's one of the rare times you don't see him listed as co-producer. Anne Margaret and Elvis did have an attraction. It's one of those where you kind of wish, why didn't they do more movies? Well, unfortunately, at the time, he was also, I don't know if he was engaged to Priscilla at the time or if it was that weird, well, she can live with me, but I'm not going to do anything until she reaches age. It was effed up no matter how you did it. But Priscilla was upset because she's reading in the gossip columns, and believe me, these were gossip columns, how her and Elvis and Aunt Margaret were already engaged to be married, and meanwhile she was engaged to Elvis, and for whatever reason they never got together again. I know Aunt Margaret talked about, you know, how Elvis really wanted to be with her, but she didn't. And although there was the chemistry, and that's why I think the movie worked. And it's, again, this is that Money in the Bank type shit, thanks to Colonel Parker. I mean, have you heard the story of why Elvis wasn't in the Barbra Streisand A Star Is Born, Corey?
No, I have not.
To make it short, Colonel Parker, here's how Colonel Parker did a deal. You give, and again, I'm going to give the money, and at the time, this was real money. You give me $100,000, you give Elvis $100,000, he's in your movie. Basically, he went to the producers of Star Is Born and said the same thing. He said, you just give me all this up front. Well, that's not the way Hollywood works. They would give Elvis points, but they're taking a chance on Elvis, being that he had acting chops, and he did. And Elvis really always wanted to be a movie, but he always got talked into doing these schmaltzy shows because, you know, he would get a big chunk of money. It would sell an album, and Parker would get his chunk of money, and they would go on until it was time to get together to another thing. So Parker basically pulled or talked Elvis out of doing it. And if you could think of Elvis at that time in the 70s, this is not before he bloated up, but I mean, even in the documentary, The Vegas Elvis, he'd have been perfect in that role as a washed up singer trying to make a comeback, taking somebody under their wing, whatever. No knocking Kris Kristofferson. It's just one of those great what ifs in history. And again, it was just because the Colonel was used to doing things his way. And Elvis and Colonel didn't really butt heads. If the Colonel said, we're not doing a movie, Elvis didn't push back, even though he would bemoan the fact that he hated doing these, I don't know what you call Elvis's movie, schlock, you know.
Elvis fans, just drive-in filler.
Yeah, and that's essentially it. You almost got to go back to King Creole or Jailhouse Rock to get anything meaningful. And there's another movie in there. I can't think of the name of it, where the biggest protest was Elvis didn't sing. So they put an Elvis song in the credits to just see Elvis had enough acting chops. And I saw a little bit of it in Viva Las Vegas. You know, like I said, his comedic timing was just hilarious. It reminded me a bit of, help me, the actor who played Niles in Frasier.
Oh, yeah. I can't think of his name, yeah, but I can't know think who you're of talking about.
And he did a couple scenes himself, just as cold openers, where it was just him doing all this comedic pratfalls. And I watched it just in tears and said, we got to stop and rewatch it. That was absolutely brilliant. So anyways, a couple of positive Elvis notes, which hopefully will get me in my wife's good graces. Corey, that's pretty much it for me. What you geeking on?
The first thing I am geeking on is, looking at the sales figures for November. The reason I bring them up is they're up. They're up. Yay. A lot. And, one other report that came out, cause I don't read my stuff on the News with the Z sites that say the comics are dying. I go to the industry sites such as ICV2, Publishers Weekly, BookScan, graphic novels up 30% last year, year over year. Now all book sales were up. Graphic novels were the highest category rise. That's not just, you know, superhero stuff. That's graphic novels across the board. And last year was a year where people were inside, so more books were sold. So it's weird how we've got this self-fulfilling prophecy that, you know, comics aren't doing well. Even when people in the industry will say, well, no, we're selling a lot of stuff. Nope. I go to this site and they say that they aren't. The other thing is that, boy, did Marvel make a lot of money off Spider-Man in November. Joe, do you remember the two Spider-Man books that came out in November?
I don't.
Spider-Man number 850 and Spider-Man number 50.
Oh, yeah.
Spider-Man number 850 was a $10 book. Spider-Man number 50 was either a $7 or an $8 book. So Marvel stomped on everybody when it came to who made the most money. The other thing is, I've often wondered, you know, these masterworks, they're really getting into the stuff that, you know, you can buy in dollar bins. And you look at the sales, and the sales are only, you know, maybe 1,000 to 1,500. But then you look at the dollar amounts. And there's a reason why, if you look at Marvel next month, and we're going to talk about it, is putting out so many omnibuses. You look at the top 10 books, money-wise, it's all masterworks and omnibuses from Marvel. Now, DC, they're off on their own little island. We don't know what they're selling, but there's a reason why Marvel is doing more and more omnibuses, because they're selling well enough that the money they make from them, and it's like Joe used to talk about with Sears, we can sell a wrench, but we'd rather sell you a fridge. And that's kind of what happened with Best Buy. Best Buy, you know, you used to go there, yeah, they'd have some appliances and stuff, but you went there for video games, and you went there for CDs, and you went there for DVDs. And now all that stuff's in a real small area. Why? They're going to make much more money selling you a new oven, a new washing machine, a new computer, a new laptop, a new, you know, a new freezer. So Marvel's going to move more and more in that direction. It's also good for those of us who like omnibuses, because it means that they're going to be putting the omnibuses that have gone out of print, they're getting them back in print. Why? Because when they get them back in print, they're the number one seller in terms of dollars. Another thing that I am geeking on is I am still reading those 70s Batman on DC Universe. They're so much better than the Batman stuff of the 90s and even today, in that they're one-issue stories. They're usually a mystery of some kind. They, because it's the early 70s, they may have a supernatural element, but it can be explained away. I just read one where Batman was reading a book of unsolved mysteries, like Amelia Earhart and things like that. And there was one about a woman who people thought, you know, her fiance said that she had been swept over the rail on a boat, but there was no proof and no body was ever found. And he starts to see the ghost of this woman everywhere he looks. Well, we find out, you know, that basically, there's a whole bunch of stuff that goes on where he discovers that she was killed. But, you know, you've got Irv Novak, Jim Aparo, Neil Adams, Denny O'Neill is writing most of this stuff. They're just good detective stories. But it's also not Batman is this invincible monster who can take down everybody in the DC universe. No, he gets punched by a mugger, and Alfred has to patch him up. He's much more vulnerable. He's much more human. And the thing that, you know, people say they used to like about Batman was, well, Batman's just a guy who's trained himself well. Well, now Batman is a guy who can do anything. And I almost wish that DC would figure out a way to scale him back so that he was just the non-powered hero who knows how to beat people up and is the world's greatest detective. But I'm really enjoying those stories. But one of the omnibuses that showed up is one I missed out on, and I'm glad that Marvel is reprinting the entire run by Ed Brubaker on Captain America. I believe it came to 5 omnibuses. They've reprinted the first one. They're soliciting the second one. The 4th and 5th I was able to get when they were dumping stuff dirt cheap. But the 1st and 2nd, and even the 3rd, were going for crazy numbers. And reading, I cracked it open. One thing, you know, most comics have a smell, and you know, that used book smell. When you open up an omnibus, it's a very chemically smell that I don't like. I don't know if you've noticed that, Joe, but when you take the plastic off an omnibus,
yeah,
and open it up, it's like, oh, I walked into a chemical factory.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, when I opened up that book I reviewed from Humanoids or whatever, you've 2016 smell. Ugh.
But I'd forgotten just how good the Ed Brubaker run was. You know, I thought, I'll read an issue or two. Next thing I know, I'm like five issues in. And even though I read it when it came out, and I read the trade paperbacks, you know, when he wrapped up his run, it's so fresh and so exciting and such a new way of seeing Captain America. And then I start thinking about the fact that he did the unthinkable. He brought back Bucky. And anybody else who brought back Bucky, they would have been pilloried. They would have been attacked. It would have been, how dare you? You've invalidated. But he did it so well, and the story was so good. Not only did people not get upset, Bucky is now one of the most important characters in the Marvel Cinematic Universe and in the regular Marvel Comics universe. And then he does the most cliched thing you could do. Well, why don't we kill him? And people didn't get mad that, it's just another stupid gimmick. No, they bought in because he built it up over time. He had a story. He had a place he was going. And it didn't feel like marketing said, raise the sales by killing the guy. Kind of like they did with Wolverine. Wolverine still, that whole death of Wolverine and his return just feels utterly botched to me. But the death of Captain America still works. So I'm really geeking about reading these stories again. And it just, you know, Ed Brubaker's one of my favorite writers. It's a damn shame he's never going to do superheroes again. But I am glad that we do get him doing his own stuff over at Image. Believe it or not, kids, you've listened to us blather on about funny books for an hour and a half.
And if you really want to win a Joe Prize, and believe me, they're still being made, go figure out how many hours we've been blathering on and on about comics. Or Elvis movies.
Or
hey, have we heard from that one guy who was starting from our first episode going forward?
I have not heard from him for a bit.
Okay.
And I haven't heard from Butch either.
Yeah. Well, you've been replaced. Don't worry.
Okay.
When Butch and I go out, we just throw a chair in the back of the truck. That's good enough for me.
So really, I'm there. It's just I'm in my John Cena cosplay.
Yes.
See me.
Exactly.
And as we say every week, the comic we like the least, we still like better than the comic that you like the most, Joe.
Corey, should I tell the guys the story about when you and I were lost in the desert? Because you saw a tree that was draped in bacon and said, a bacon tree, we're saved. And you ran up to the tree and then you got shot up with bullets. Unfortunately, folks, it wasn't a bacon tree. It was a hambush. I live for those sighs. Corey, I don't feel like really dancing, but I am well enough to do the white man two-step. Hit my music.
Done, bitches!